This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I wish you a wide audience, but, you know, for this episode, you know, I feel like maybe people will turn it off a couple minutes in, and that's okay with me.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer,
bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Luke Geddes. Luke Geddes holds a PhD in comparative literature and creative writing from the University of Cincinnati. Originally from Appleton, Wisconsin, he lived in Cincinnati and now lives in Milwaukee. He's the author of the novel Heart of Junk, the short story collection I Am a Magical Teenage Princess, and his writing has appeared in Conjunctions, Mid-American Review, Hayden's Fairy Review, Washington Square Review, The Comics Journal, Electric Literature, and elsewhere. Welcome, Luke.
Welcome.
Hello, it's wonderful to be here.
I feel like I've been such a fan of yours for years, but I've never...
Oh, really? This is the first I'm hearing of it.
My bad. I like to save it until the very end, you know?
I do think that there's something to be said. You know, we don't have a lot of, like, quiet fans anymore. Like, everyone's always, like, having to, like, tell everyone how much they love each other's work.
That's right.
It's like I like to imagine, you know, a bunch of people I know nothing about who have never talked to me, who like don't exist to me, but are still like, you know, huge admirers of my work. To
We're
me, that's
there.
Like the ideal relationship between, you know, creator and the audience.
It is nice because you never have to worry about like what we'll say that you have to then interpret. We just never it's say like, anything.
Sometimes you'll get it, you know, if you get it, I don't get a lot of these. I think I get fewer than anyone in the world, but like a fan email. And then it's just like, oh man, now I have to respond to this fan email. And it's like, it's usually just like someone who's like, oh, I liked your book. And then, you know, my reply is like even more complimentary, even though I don't know who they are or anything about them. But it's just like, I have to pay it back, and I just go way overboard. Like, this was a beautiful fan email you sent me. Like, you are the person who should be receiving the fan mail.
Well, I mean, I can relate. Like,
for the guy who said at the end of the nice email that it seemed like I had a deadline and that the book really rushed through the end.
Oh my god.
That was at the end of like a nice email.
Oh, God.
I like nicely, my coworker asked me for a copy of Daddy's. And I was like, you know, here you go. Like, thanks for asking or whatever. And he read it and he like was like, I have some feedback. So let me know when it's good to like meet up and talk about it. I was like,
yeah,
never.
That's very weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, God bless him.
But at least, I mean, I feel like that person's still in like the top percentile of like random, sorry about the dog barking, of random people asking to read your work, is that he actually like read it.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
just he that he read it in the worst possible way.
He read it and he was like, ugh.
God.
One person that read your work and loved your work is Roxane Gay, who in her By the Book said, that I'm a Magical Teenage Princess was her favorite book no one has ever heard of.
That, see, I'm glad you put it that way, because sometimes people, like if they have to introduce me at a reading or something, will say like, oh, Roxy Ann Gay said this was one of her favorite books. Like, they take out that no one has ever heard of part. And to me, like, that's the most important part. That's the best part.
Do you think she was assuming things? This is a big assumption, right?
Oh, no, it wasn't. If you saw like how much that book sold, it's not an assumption at all.
It's a fact.
It is an absolute fact. And to me, like, you know, I like books that no one has ever heard of. So it's like, I can only aspire to write books that no one has ever heard of.
Can you return the favor to an author right now and say your favorite book no one's ever heard of?
Oh, man, it's such a great question. That's really hard. Well, you know what? I'm just looking at my bookshelf here. There's this book. It's called Hadley Lee Lightcap by Sam Sweet.
So you made that up.
I mean, if you saw the book, it's a really nice cover. It's got like indents for the letters, but it's like mostly plain white. This is it's a biography of this band that no one's ever heard of called Acetone.
Oh my god.
You know, it's like self-published basically, right? Which is always like a little dicey. But it's like, oh, it's amazing. It's like an amazing, it's not just about this band, it's like about the history of like surf culture in California. It's about like conceptual art and just how this band was like this nexus point for like all these different things that happened, and how this is like a classic, like tragic story of a band that like should have been and had like everything going for it to be like a big successful band, and like every terrible thing that could happen within a band, including like the suicide of the band leader, happened.
God.
Oh, it's to me, this should be like, I mean, it's too good to be in the 33 and a third series. It should be like its own thing that everyone reads, even people who don't care about this band, because it's incredibly well written too.
What else has Sam Sweet written? Other things?
It's a really mysterious thing too, because there's just like this, I know nothing about this guy, but he has like a website. And it's just like this book and then these like other little books that he put out that I haven't read. Like, my imagination is like he's some like millionaire like hobbyist who just like puts out these books that like nobody reads, which is like the ideal career, I think.
That's, yeah. And also Sam Sweet, not his real name, right?
I feel like I did a little research and it was his real name.
What?
The website is cool. Like, this is,
yeah,
this is like, awesome. It's like someone who like knows what they're doing and knows what they are, but it's like, I don't, the book got a little bit of traction, the Acetone book, because like it was paired with like a reissue of their music, but then like everything else is just like, I don't even, it's such a mysterious thing. I don't, it's sort of like that, there's that guy who's like sending his random like foodie.
Yeah. Right.
It feels kind of like that.
Yeah. And it's on this thing called All Night Menu. And All Night Menu is a history of Los Angeles told in 5 installments. Each booklet contains 8 addresses. Each address reveals a different strand of LA culture. By the end of the series, there will be 5 volumes and 40 stories drawn from all time periods, subcultures, and sections of the city. The first 4 volumes were released between 2013 and 2022. The 5th and final volume will be released in 2023.
This website is crazy. Like, this website is fucking awesome. I'm clicking around it. There's like a clip from Tulane Blacktop and one of these like a piece of short fiction. There's like, this is fucking batshit crazy.
It's samsweet.info.
Let's get this guy on the line. Let's
right?
get Sam.
Oh yeah, come on the pod, Sam.
What?
Let's see if his phone number's on his website.
Man, Luke, that was a great answer to the question. I thought, you know, the way you started, I was like, man, he's going to fumble this, but you handled well.
Well, thank you. I'm glad. I'm sure like all my like friends will be like, well, why didn't you? I don't have that many friends, first of all, but I'm sure my like one or two friends will be like, you should have talked about my book.
No. This is clearly the right answer.
Well, it's like, I want to like, pull in like a stranger no one's ever heard of. So there you go.
I think, definitely.
Is Sam Sweet a woman?
I don't think so. Because there's a little bit of autobiography. I mean, if Sam Sweet was a woman, that would be a mind blower for me. Because that's just another like piece of information I don't know about this mysterious figure.
Well, we should, there's an email. We should just send an email and say, hey, you were mentioned on this podcast.
I know I had to email them to get the book because it was like sold out at the time.
They're in they have some stuff in the Paris Review.
Okay, so they're connected. They're an insider now. We're not interested anymore.
Yeah, in the fuck Paris Sam Review. Sweet. They're in the New York Times Magazine. Okay, forget it.
Fuck you, Sam.
I know the New York Times thing was just in conjunction with the reissue of the acetone compilation. And I remember the New York Times was a little dismissive of the book as like, oh, here's this like extra thing that you can get with this record when it's like a beautiful thing that stands on its own, in my opinion.
I am going to get a copy of it. I'm excited to read it.
It's good. And it's like, you know, I don't usually listen to music when I read like prose fiction, but it's like number one, like you don't need to listen to the music while you read it because like the way he describes, like it's like the most precise and accurate description of music, not just the band's music, but their influences. But it's also like, it's a vibe kind of book too, where like cool. You can really listen to that. You can put on the album and, you know, really vibe out while you read about it.
It's awesome.
I think Sam Sweet is on a LA Review of Books podcast from 2015.
Okay, that Ooh. Sounds about, that sounds right. Yeah.
And yeah, he seems like a normal person.
Well, that's a disappointment.
He's wearing two shirts in his picture though, so I mean, you know.
Two collars?
He's got like a sweater and a shirt underneath.
Mm, I love a two collar if the shirts are of the same thickness. Like if you're wearing a flannel shirt and then another flannel shirt and it's two collars, it just tells me everything I need to know about you. And that is that I love you.
See, I wouldn't expect that from Sam Sweet because that doesn't sound very Californian.
Good point.
Okay. We have delayed the inevitable long enough. Luke, it's time for you to read.
Do you have the tape ready?
I've got the tape ready.
Cool.
Okay, so I'm just going to read a part of the novel. And it's going to be pretty quick because as I was saying before, I'm not a huge fan of reading my own work. I think of myself as an imperfect vessel for it. But I'm just going to read a few paragraphs from a part of the book. It's set in an antique mall, like a multi-dealer antique mall. The book is called Heart of Junk. And it's got a bunch of different characters in it, different point of view characters. And this section is in the point of view of a character named Ellie, who is like the teenage daughter of the owners of this antique mall. And for various reasons, like instead of going to college, she has to stay home and work at the antique mall.
Okay.
So I'll start now. This place was a graveyard. Ellie's parents had owned it since as long as she could remember, and she'd worked here off and on since she was 13. But recent years had seen the heart of America in decline. In some booths, the same merchandise had been sitting out for so long that it literally moldered. Except in Hall 1, where the most steadfast and well-to-do dealers had always clustered, walking the aisles brought you past the empty spaces and dust impressions of once reliable renters gone AWOL. Her parents had recently let go of all the full-time employees, forcing Ellie to fill in for an entire workforce and cut the store's hours by a third. Ellie did not pay much attention to current events. Wichita was so culturally isolated from the rest of the world, it didn't seem like anything on a national scale would ever penetrate it. but it probably had something to do with what was called the financial crisis by the pixie-haired cable news anchor Keith Watch Knightley, and on whom he seemed to have a schoolboy crush. Either that or the customers had awoken one day to the epiphany that they'd been spending their hard-earned money on what was essentially garbage. She never admitted to them, but when her parents used to bring her here as a kid, there'd been a magical quality to it, like the underground caverns in the My Secret Princess cartoons, full of hidden treasure and harboring its own population of misfits and eccentrics. But now during the slow hours, it felt outright post-apocalyptic, abandoned by all but the small cohort of plaintive losers who considered themselves Heart of America regulars. Keith sat on his stool at the opposite end of the counter and took an indecent bite out of a stale cruller and chugged coffee from a crusty old mug featuring the comic strip character Ziggy, a depressive endomorph. Ziggy reminded Ellie of Keith. "Ellie," he said tentatively, and just the tone he'd used four or five different times to explain the best thing for the whole family right now was for her to postpone her going away plans and stick it out in Wichita. "Are you all right?" No, she was not all right. Not as long as she was awake and conscious of what her life had become. She recalled a Health Channel special on the sex lives of Siamese twins. In it, sisters who shared half a skull held hands with their respective husbands, lumpy, acne-scarred men who glared at the camera with pride and embarrassment while explaining the mechanics of conjoined intercourse. "When it's their turn," one sister said, "I just tune it all out, let my mind enter into a place of nothingness." Ellie lacked such a talent, but fortunately there were substances that could achieve similar ends, and she'd need them to get through this shift. Okay, that's all I'll read.
So you never, like, read your work? Do you ever read it out loud to yourself when you're writing?
I do in kind of a mumbly way. I've read my work. I read my work sort of when I have to. But like if I can do something else for like an author appearance, like a Q&A or just like a weird random talk, I usually do that. But you know, I respect the reading hustle. I respect readers. But it's not my favorite thing to do.
I agree with you. I like being at readings if I can be towards the back and there's something to drink, but the actual reading part is my least favorite part. So I can relate to that.
Yeah. I feel like it's like, you know, sometimes you go see a band or whatever and it's like, you know, I'd say like one out of like 10 times or like one out of five, if you're being more generous, it's like, it's good and you can get into it and the sound is good and you're not distracted. But then like the other times you just sort of go out as a way to like be there. And it's like the stuff before and after is really, you know, the main event.
Yes.
And I think with readings, that's like almost like 100% of the time. It's just like, and so yeah. I don't understand why there's readings. It should just be the stuff before and after.
Has there ever been a reading that you were like, okay, that there was a purpose for that. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, there were a couple. One, you know, I saw Tom Drury, and you know, I'm like very, very familiar with his work, and the way he read it was like, just like here's a bunch of short funny parts, like here's one scene, here's another scene. And he didn't really worry too much about like setting it up and or like, you know, doing like a long self-contained narration. It was just like, here are some of the hits, and I thought that was good. And I saw Jenny Offal read from Department of Speculation in a way that like totally change my mind about the book. You know, I thought the book sort of was lukewarm for me as like a reading experience, but then hearing it read aloud made me like really appreciate what it was and what it was doing. So that was like kind of a lucky one to go to.
Mm-hmm. What is it that she did?
I just think that I think number one, like I approached the book in an ungenerous way of like, oh, here's another one of those like
fragmented books,
you know, possibly like veiled autobiography or whatever. But the live reading was like it really revealed, I think, and emphasized like the intimacy of the book.
Mm.
And it's interesting too, because like neither one were like what I would call like your sort of like superstar, like Hollywood charisma style readers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know who would like, probably like a Neil Gaiman type or something. Like it wasn't, they were just like people who like read their book pretty, they didn't do like reader voice or poet voice, but they
That's
were pretty.
The, yes. That's yeah. The key right there. Is not to do that voice.
I mean that's the key, that's like the first part, but then the second, it's really hard actually to like, I think, read in your own actual voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they both did to certain degrees.
I on purpose read, I the only thing I think is read slow. And I deliberately read slow because when I'm at a reading, I have trouble following anything that is being said, and I'm just like, I want this to be slower. And also, I don't like, me personally, I just don't like the idea of performing the writing, which I know is probably like antithetical to the way a lot of people approach it, but I just am like, I'm like, I am literally going to read this.
I mean to me that's the best reading you can do. I would say like I'm just not a good listener at readings. Like even if it's something like I've already read, I'm familiar with, or like something I'm interested in, I know that I'm just gonna, my mind's gonna wander and I've lost it all. So I just go, and to me it's like a meditative thing. Like I'm just gonna sit there. I'm really good at like looking attentive, but I'm really there for like, you know, chatting with the author for 2 minutes afterwards, or talking to the people around me the few minutes before.
Right.
But actual reading is not that important to me, because I know that I'm just not going to listen. I'm going to lose track of it.
Yeah. I will say,
but I shouldn't give away my secrets. Now no, every time do. I go to a reading, everyone's going to be like, this asshole's not even listening.
This motherfucker, he's not even listening.
Motherfucker Luke Geddes, god damn it, he's
listen,
here.
Listen, anyone in Milwaukee doing readings, and start incorporating pop quizzes.
You were just going to say, start incorporating Luke.
Do you like audiobooks?
No, for the same reason, is like I can't.
You're just not like an audio. Attention. Yeah. Okay.
I listen to podcasts because you can, you know, if you miss a few words, you just keep going. But if it's like a narrative, I don't want to miss anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we do podcasts, because, you know, you miss a few words. It's like, whatever. The best a podcast can be is a C-. So I guess we're still here.
Oh my God.
If I could like fold my laundry and do dishes at a literary reading, I could probably pay more attention to it.
You know what? That is a good idea. You bring your dirty dishes and you just fucking go to town, and you have a little soundproof. I mean, we're used to like the contained spaces now, COVID forever. So you just get like a little booth, and you do the plates, the mugs, and so on.
That's my ideal audience. I think I would be flattered to see that.
I would love to attend that with you. Just next booth over.
I feel like there was a brief period of time where everyone accepted that like readings can be torturous and boring, and everyone did their best not to be torturous and boring. But I feel like it's swinging the other way.
I feel like you're right about that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you ran a reading series forever that had a whistle to get people the fuck off. Yeah. I mean, coming from you, this is funny. It's funny that you just like presented it that way. I feel like there was a time.
When... But we weren't the only ones. I mean, you know, like it was happening. It was happening all over the nation.
Everyone had their goddamn whistle out.
There's a real like, as soon as, I don't know why people don't just admit this and recognize this as like a whole community of writers, but like there's a recess feeling the second the reading ends. Everyone is so like true. So much happier. There's energy in the room, and it's like Why don't we recognize that, like, that's where the energy is?
You're torturing, like, people.
God, it's so true. Recess feeling. That's such a great way to put it.
Yeah, I have noticed, like, the few... I've been doing some events at this local bookstore with writers coming through with their books, and it's been straight conversation. Like, it used to be like, you're going to read a little bit or whatever. But now it's just... I think we've stopped torturing people.
Well, yeah, that's the other interesting thing is when I did the tour for my novel, I said, like, I don't want to read. You know, if you can find, you know, authors or whoever who wants to do like a Q&A, like, I'd much prefer that. And the publicist was like, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting to hear. Actually, you know, we know that, you know, audiences and readers actually like the Q&A format a lot more than straight readings, mm-hmm. also. Mm-hmm. And that just made me think, well, why does anyone do readings then? This should stop.
I think it's like you're saying, it's a chance to hang out with each other.
You can hang out with each other without having a reading.
That's true, but it's also a way for us to, like, kiss each other's asses, right? Like, oh, that was so moved.
Well, no, I guess no one's ever kissed my ass after a reading. That's probably why I don't like them.
Wow. Listen, when's your next reading?
It's actually in like a week and a half. So.
Oh my gosh. My God.
Way to bury the lead. Jesus Christ.
Well, we would publicize it on here, but this ain't coming out till like October. So
that's good. I'm glad of that.
Luke shows up, sees an empty room, leaves.
I've seen it. I saw some empty rooms on the book tour, or almost empty. So
wasn't it during the pandemic, like early days pandemic?
Your book came out in January 2020, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I always would say, like, I had the last book tour because like, as soon as, like, there were like a couple legs of the book tour, and as soon as, like, the last thing I did is, like, number one, like, I probably got COVID from book tour, and number two is, like, the pandemic, like, really started like 2 weeks after I was done with my book tour.
Oh my God. How long was your, like, where did you go on your book tour? How involved was it?
Well, there was like a leg of like four or five like things that I drove to. So there was like the hometown Cincinnati reading, and then some other places in driving distance, like Ann Arbor and Toledo, you know, all the huge stops. The Toledo, Perrysburg, Ohio, the Cincinnati reading. And then there were some places I flew to, Denver and St. Louis and Dallas. And then there was one more event I did like a couple weeks after that in Oxford, Tennessee. So they really kept me out of like the coast. They were like, the, you know, the New York City people, the California people, they don't want anything to do with a country bumpkin like you.
And a book that's set in Wichita.
That, oh, the Wichita reading, of course, was, you know, a real throwdown.
What's your ideal relationship to your fans?
Ideal relationship? Do you want me to repeat what I said before?
Yeah.
I feel like you can just slice it in, but it you know, I like the idea of like people who basically don't exist to me. I never interact with them. I never hear from them. They don't write emails to me, but I know there's like a huge mass of
silence. So how do you know?
Well, I think there's something to be said for like the unknown part of that. It's like, if they don't make themselves known, there's the potential that they could number in like the millions.
How many readers exist in the world right now? It can't be a million. It's got to be like
the number I keep hearing is 20,000.
Yeah,
20,000 people that know how to read. I mean,
yeah, it's not a lot. It's not a lot.
It's really not a lot.
If I mean, possibly like they're, you know, they're illegally downloading copies of the book because it probably doesn't. They don't show up in sales. Like, that's how that's how silent, unseen a majority they are. It's like they don't even want me to know that they're buying the book or even checking it out from the library.
That's how devoted they are to your just idiosyncrasies, I guess.
That's how silent they are. That's that is the best.
They're just deadly they
respect,
silent.
Yeah, they respect boundaries.
Big time. They invent boundaries and then they actually exceed the limits of those boundaries.
I feel like this should have a name like Morgellons, but you know, for invisible fans.
No, they're fans. IFs. IFs.
IFs, yes.
IFs.
I have a case of the IFs, which is great. Who wouldn't want that?
My God.
Everyone is just so public with like expressing the things that they like, and you know, maybe they should just keep their mouth shut.
Okay, but there's like people who say those things, but they're saying them to get attention for themselves, right?
Oh, yeah. Course.
I guess
rather than celebrating,
it would be nice if like the post office dropped off like an actual physical bag of fan mail that you know I wouldn't have to open or read, but it would just like exist.
What if you just get an if report and it just had a number, a growing number?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Just in the middle of the page, you know.
A graph?
No, just a number.
Just a number.
Yeah, just like, you know, 7,000, 1,200.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like two different numbers.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be okay.
What color paper do you want?
I want it on black ink on black paper, so I'll never actually.
Oh my God. Perfect answer.
Oh, this is delightful.
Yeah, I'm happy. This is the kind of thing I could do every day.
Well, we could do a daily podcast.
Yeah, I know. It's already, we have it in the calendar. We're just pretending for the audience that it's not already set up.
We owe it to your ifs.
That's true. Luke, I've asked you questions about this book before. And I read over our interview that we did for Heavy Feather Review, and I thought, God, I love this crazy book. I forgot because it was like 2 years ago, right? That we did that.
Oh yeah, it's old news. And it's all in the remainder bin by now.
Well, that's okay. We like the remainder bin. But one thing I hadn't asked you about that I had either mentioned in an email or I had read it in another interview you'd done or something was the actual sale of this book to Simon & Schuster was kind of a strange series of events. And I was just hoping that you could just tell us that story.
Okay. I don't think I talked about it. I haven't done that many interviews for obvious reasons. I think this was just something we talked about. Is I think what you're referring to is like, so the book was like out on submission. I feel like it was out on submission for a long time. I feel like, you know, including listening to this podcast, I feel like authors are always like, oh, the book was out on submission for 3 weeks. Those are terrible 3 weeks. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I feel like my book was out on submission for like a year or like many months or something,
because
I don't even really know that many of the details, because I just asked my agent to like not really tell me anything. I wasn't, unless there was like good news or like I got, you know, the only thing I got sort of forward to me were sort of like a couple like positive or like kind rejections.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, like, I really don't want the play-by-play. I don't even want to know, like, who it's going to or where it's going to at any given time.
I think that's the right way to go.
God, we are wired so different. I said, send me everything. I want to know everything.
I did too, and I regret that.
I actually regret it as well.
Yeah, I don't know why you... I don't understand. Even, like, getting the positive rejections just, like, pissed me off. Like, even, like, nicest, kindest, like, you know, blah, 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 but no, it's like, well, to me, that just reads like you're talking yourself out of like taking the book to get, you know, a thoughtful response and then a no.
Mm-hmm.
So it was out, like, I don't even understand, like, it's, you know, it still seems mysterious to me because it's like, it doesn't seem like there's that really that many places to like send a book, but then there's like, you know, imprint upon imprint that are under different umbrellas. But it was out, and it was like it was actually collecting like a fair amount of like positive rejections, which, you know, I was assured like that wasn't always the case, but it still was like pretty cold comfort because a rejection's a rejection. I don't really care how nice it is.
What were they saying in your rejections?
I don't know, remember any specifics, because I'm pretty sure like I just like, you know, skimmed it in the way that you're like, your eyes are like really like gliding over it because you don't want to take in the content of what's being said. You know, I think what everyone says, like from, you know, from the bottom of the chain to the top is like, oh, you know, I love this. This is the greatest book I've ever read in my entire life. Blah, blah, blah. But I don't know how to sell it. So it was probably like stuff along those lines. You're like, I don't see the market for it. Which I, you know, I appreciate that kind of like cravenly like commercial mindset. But to me, it's like, well, you work in literary fiction. So you should just like publish like the trashiest, like lowest common denominator stuff if your goal is to like cater to a market. Like it's absurd to like say that you are interested in literary fiction if your main goal is to like, it's like I you know, I really want to sell to 5 people, right? it doesn't make sense to me. But, you know, people, I think the thing, so the anyway, I think what Alex was wants you to talk about is the book at the, you know, the publisher and the editor rejected it. So it's published by Simon & Schuster under the editor, Sean Manning. And hopefully you won't be mad that I mentioned this, but I'm sure it'll be okay. But it wasn't. You know, sometimes you'll get a thing where it's like, you'll get a response that's like, I need to think about this. It's a maybe. But I got a response from him that was, you know, one of these thoughtful responses that at the end is like an unequivocal no. Like, I found much to appreciate about this. You know, I like this and that, but, you know, I'm going to pass on it. So it wasn't ambiguous. It was a definitive no. And then like a couple days later, it changed to like, oh, I've been thinking about it. You know, I've been talking about it with, you know, the other people at the publisher, the imprint, and we changed our mind. We'll take it.
Oh my God.
Which seems so like crazy. And to me, like that's the only way. It just seemed like fitting. Like, this is the only way I'll get a yes is like after I've been crushed by a no. Like, I'll never have a success or like an acceptance that feels like, oh, I won the lottery, I'm so happy. I'll just have a yes or a success that's just like, oh, I'm relieved of the pain and anxiety I was feeling, but I'm not especially like excited or happy about it.
I've never heard of that happening before.
I know, it's crazy.
And it just, I mean, to me, it just reinforced the feeling of like a lot of rejections that are like positive and detailed being the person talking themselves out of it.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I can definitely relate to that. I told the story on the last podcast, I think, because my book is actually sold, Luke, but we haven't announced it like online or anything, but because of the orders of episodes, like we talked about it on the last one. But I had an experience where the rejection was exactly what you were I had several like you were describing, where it was like they're talking themselves out of the book. But then the cruelest one, in my opinion, one I got, and by no means do I think it was intentionally cruel, but the impact certainly was that there was a line in it that said something like, I would have bought this a couple years ago when I had time to actually edit books. And
yeah.
It's just like, oh God,
that is so fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like extremely, that does a really good job, I think, of encapsulating like this point in publishing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You're like hilarious, and your writing is so funny. And I want to know if you think it's easy to write that way or hard to write that way.
I don't know if I would think of it as like easy or hard. I just think I'm not interested in writing that's not funny in some ways. And I think your question is good, Lindsay. I think I get a variation on like the humor or like the comic fiction question that often boils down to like, you know, why is this funny?
Oh.
Where I feel like no one is ever like, oh, I noticed your book was like totally humorless. It's really like dead serious. Like, why did you decide to write a book without any sense of humor at all? No one ever asked that question, but people ask like, well, why did you write a funny book? I wish they would ask people why their books are not funny, but they don't.
There are, you know what the problem is, Luke? They'd have to ask so many people that fucking question that
that's right.
That it would take up all their time. They'd have to be backtracking into their reading logs and just, it's too many people to talk to.
I'm just curious. I would actually be genuinely curious. Like, oh, I noticed you have like, you know, such a self-serious book. Like, what made you choose? Because, you know, being funny is seen as like a choice, which it doesn't really feel like a choice for me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Being serious isn't seen as like a conscious choice.
It's funny though, because I feel like I'm not going to say all, but I would probably the majority of the books that I finish or read the first four pages of and think, oh, this is self-serious. A lot of times the echo of that statement is that it feels like a pose. Like, it feels more like a extreme choice to me a lot of times when these books are so self-serious. It's like, this is my big art moment, or like, this is my big genius chance here. And it's like, well, you read like all the other assholes who try to do this. You're not doing it.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I find it hard to be funny. Like, to be funny in the way that you're funny, which is like, I don't know, just like truly funny. I think some of my stuff is funny for like very specific people.
Your stuff is funny. I mean, that's
sometimes, but I you know, I would like to be more funny in my writing. But it often goes too far, or like is so particular that it's like a very specific, it's like basically my high school friend Robbie that would think it was funny.
I think that I would say first, like, I think that's like the best kind of like comedy, is that kind of specificity.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the other thing I was going to say, but I'm sure it was good.
I'm sure it was too. I
would say, even as a reader, like, if I read like a bad, self-serious, humorless book, like obviously I won't think it's funny, but I often think of most things I read as funny, even if like other people don't find them funny. I just mm-hmm. remember a lot of times in like classes, like, you know, boring like literature seminars or whatever, like I would think books were funny or parts of things we were talking about were funny, and I just remember a lot of people like looking horrified, like mm-hmm. you thought that was funny.
Did you used to laugh like when you'd be in trouble with your parents?
I didn't really get in trouble. I'm a rule follower.
Wow. Okay. Good to know.
I feel like when people admit that, I just don't trust it. Like, I don't know. It feels crazy to me to say you're a rule follower. It feels like then you're just, it's like a ploy to get away with more. I mean, I respect the move, but it's hard to take it face value for me.
Well, you read that perfectly, because that is the truth. Is, you know, I would just not admit to, I wouldn't get in trouble because I wouldn't acknowledge that I did anything wrong.
You're so good at like like collecting ephemera, like your Instagram. I think of it as like a gallery of stuff, like like pop culture and kitsch and like truly wonderful finds that you somehow discover. And your art is like that too. And your writing is like the literary embodiment of collage. And I want to hear you talk about the intersection between like what you're making on the page and what you make with your hands.
That's a tough question. So you're talking about like the collage art?
Well, even just the way that you see things. Yeah. So the collage art, which is incredible, your Instagram, and you know, the things that you write about, it feels like there's this like through line.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I'm just, you know, I'm always, it's sort of like, it goes back to sort of where we started, which is like thinking about like, oh, the best whatever that you've never heard of, or like the under-acknowledged or like obscure things. And so I often say like, oh, well, you know, most of my favorite books are out of print. And, you know, when I think about that and sort of like face myself, you know, I wonder, is it, you know, is it that I have such like esoteric taste, or is there something about like knowing the fact that it's out of print, or like knowing that something is sort of obscure or neglected or like under appreciated? Like, am I like compelled just on that basis to like become invested and interested in it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has to do with that. It has to do with just like, I mean, it mostly has to do with just like watching Nick at Night as a kid. Yes. And just like watching TV like nonstop. Where, mm-hmm. To me, like I didn't understand like that when you went to a museum and you would go to like a World War II exhibit and everything was in black and white. To me, it was like, oh, this is real history. But when you put on Nick at Night and Bewitched was in black and white, I would be like, this is also real history. Like, I didn't really see a difference between like what was just like totally ephemeral and like, you know, as you said, like kitschy, and what was like actually like important.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like all the same stew.
Mm. I mean, in a way that is very prescient, like, because if you just think about our culture now, like the yeah. only fucking thing people care about is comic book movies that make billions of dollars. And I don't know if it feels connected back to a time when like there were people who understood like a scratch that not understood, but it just feels like, I don't know, it feels like some like perverted outgrowth of that in a way to me. Not that I want to connect those things, because I love Bewitched and I don't like Marvel movies.
I this is dicey territory perhaps, but like I feel that you know, when you look at like, I can like endlessly watch like a terrible old sitcom, not like a Full House or like a Saved by the Bell. Like, I could just like, you know, even if it's something I didn't grow up on, like even taking nostalgia out of it, like, you know, like I'll watch like those old like AIP, like Frankie and Annette Beach movies, or like the movies that Elvis made,
mm-hmm.
which it's not like that's like emblematic of my childhood. It's from way before. I can watch that stuff and I find it, that stuff really fascinating, you know, for one, like as like, you know, just detritus from a particular time and place. But I think it's also interesting to see a product like the directors and writers of those movies didn't think they were doing anything like great. They knew they were just like churning out like crap for the masses to be disposed right. of. And to me, like, I love that stuff, and it's so fascinating, and it reveals itself in ways it didn't intend to. Whereas like the stuff that's sort of disposable pop culture nowadays is produced by people who like take it really seriously and think like it's really like an important feminist message to see She-Hulk dancing or whatever.
Oh,
and that's like, so that's not interesting to me at all.
No, that's a great way of putting it. Like my favorite thing in the world is Adam West Batman. Like Batman 66 stuff is like, that's my version of what I could watch all the time. And I did grow up watching the reruns, but it's obviously not of my era. And same thing with Green Lantern of that era. But, and the thing that I can relate to in what you said is that there was such a sense of fun watching you watch those episodes, less so with Green Lantern, but, and you know, the guy who created it is also doing the narration on the show. And it's like, there's no reason why someone would do that unless they just wanted to participate and be a part of what is being made and can sense it as a made thing. Because it also wouldn't be like an economic decision. And just little things like that, the fact that the sets were so bizarre and, you know, unique week to week and yet recycled week to week in funny ways and repurposed. And there is such a sense of it being a made thing. I don't know, which I think is really smart to point out what you said. It's like a less, I don't know, sickening enterprise than what's going on now.
And it's not necessarily like the people like making that stuff are like they were so like dumb or they were so cynical. No, but I think there was just like an understanding like, okay, this is the candy, you know, and this is like the cultural candy in a context where there's also like, you know, the New Yorker and, you know, literature. Whereas now it's like, well, we're just gonna, you know, wrap the candy, all, it's all candy now. Mm-hmm. Right, the candy is the only thing. If you're gonna get, you need to get your like high-minded like philosophy from She-Hulk, because you're not also gonna read a book. I don't know whatever, but the Marvel fans are already like swarming like my social media, which I don't have very big followings anyway, but come at me. I don't care.
Can you talk about moving from writing short stories to writing the novel and back again?
Well, I'm never going back to short stories. There's no money in it.
No. Is there not? Is there money in novels? Because that's news to me.
There's like marginally more money. And it's like... some money is better than like $0. Mm-hmm. Actually like negative money because of like the insane like pay to submit scheme that has been normalized by an awful like sick moribund literary culture. But anyway, about short stories, I've only read short stories for the longest time. I would just read short story collections. I only wanted to write short stories. And then I think I just really sort of overdosed on short stories. I'm talking even more as a reader than a writer. Like I really felt like I was seeing the same kind of feeling and the same kind of moves, the same kind of structures in stories. And I think one thing I liked about short stories as a reader was like I really appreciated the structure. The fine sense of structure they sort of have to have. But I think I got sort of overwhelmed with that. And the appeal of like the big formless thing that is a novel became appealing to me. I don't know, maybe that's like a lie. I think maybe it was just like, I felt like I had to write a novel because that's the thing you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the novel was almost designed where it's like, I would never in a million years call it a novel in stories. And I would like burn it if it had that on it. Because I don't think it is a novel in stories. And I don't like the idea of marketing something as a novel in stories. But it changes point of view like every single chapter, and there's like a million characters in it. So I think, you know, you can see a lot of like my coming out of short stories from it, because, you know, what I really liked in short stories was writing like beginnings.
Mm.
And I didn't really like the middles, and I especially didn't like ending as much. And so I felt like the way to get through an entire novel as a writer writing a novel was to like keep writing the first chapter over and over again. So when it changes point of view, it's like, yes, I get to start over. I get to write a new beginning of a story And then once I had, I don't even remember how many different point of view characters are, but once I had so many, you know, let's say 7 or 8 starts, it's like, well, those beginnings, those chapters and different points of view all introduce stuff that I now have to deal with. So I have like problems to work through. And so you can really see the novel, I think, as, you know, there's chapters in the first half that are like the first half of this character's story. And then in the second half of the novel, here's the second half of that character's story.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I was bad mouthing the short story as a form and genre, which I would never do, except when we're talking like flash fiction.
Wait.
No, I mean, I share this with Luke.
What, that you hate flash fiction?
Just abolish flash fiction. That's what I think. That I actually want to change the intro to the show just to abolish flash fiction. No music or anything. We just chant that.
What about people when people don't even call it like flash fiction? They say like my flash. I'm pleased to share. Oh, all the time. I'm pleased to share my latest flash with you. I had an idea. I couldn't figure out. I'm not like a programmer or whatever. I had an idea for like a Twitter account that would automatically retweet anytime anyone said they were thrilled and honored.
Oh God.
To do something or to publish something. It would be the thrilled and honored bot.
That's good. Man. I like that. Also, so someone, humble bot
can get on it.
Yeah.
Humble bot. That's good. That's a good name for it.
There's like this, the Flash community has been overtaken by like some weenies.
Listen, the Flash community right now, not like in my day with Flash.
Right. I mean, I don't want to get academic about it necessarily, but I feel like you can make a link to like, there's definitely a capitalistic mindset to like, you know, Flash is like the highest yield form of writing and publication because it doesn't take as long to write. I'm sure some nerd will be like, well, actually I worked for 3 years on this Flash, but who cares? But it doesn't take, so if your goal is to rack up those publications and really pad out that CV, you would be crazy to write like 10 page stories when you could write. I mean, this is fiction writers like discovering what poets have known all along. It's like,
oh my God.
Spread those seeds far and wide and keep it short.
God, I like when the blurbs on the back of a poetry book, if you just were to put them in the book, it would double the length of the book, which is usually the case. If next time you pick up a poetry book, look how long the fucking blurbs are. They are ungodly.
People should get better at blurbs in general because we're all recycling the same shit. Mm-hmm. And like you should be treating it as a like an opportunity to show that you're a good writer.
Mm-hmm. We should be allowed to use pictures.
Or yeah, like
She-Hulk, you know,
like say something exciting in an exciting way rather mm-hmm. than like I was moved by the mordant blah blah blah. You know, it's just like, can we just be creative?
But sometimes you see people like being a little too creative with the blurb.
Don't you ever. Absolutely.
You can't win.
No, you really can't win.
I feel like all you really, they should just have like a list of endorsements and just like name the authors.
PepsiCo.
We don't need to hear what they say.
Maybe it should just be like, do you like sex scenes in Target and
yes,
hot dogs with ketchup?
No.
And like sunsets where yes, there's a bomb, then you'll love this book. Done. You know?
That's good. I like that. Or just like list some colors. See if you vibe with those. Fuchsia, teal.
Pink. Yeah, there you go. What's the aura of this book?
Mm-hmm.
That's your new career venture.
Luke, you started a record company. Is that right? With your advance for Heart of Junk? Or do I have the order of events wrong here?
No, that's right. That's right. I started a failing record company. With part of my advance, yeah.
Do you lathe?
I don't. This was a real deal plant. I mean, this is, it started. You know, if someone has like a really great record that knocks my socks off the way that this record did, I would add it to the roster, proudly, and waste, more of my personal finances. But, this is just this is an album by, another sort of, I would say, like, weird guy that no one's ever heard of, much like the theme of this episode, named Benjamin Dean Wilson. I would say for fans of, a diverse array of artists, including, let's say, Randy Newman, Father John Misty, The Kinks, et cetera. Leonard Cohen. He's definitely a Leonard Cohen acolyte. He's a, he's really a, his songs are the best short stories I've heard or read in many years. And so, I had his first album, and he had his second album only on like his Bandcamp. And I just kept looking at this beautiful record that he had for his first album. And I asked him, like, when's the second album coming out on vinyl? Because I'm just an idiot who needs to have that on vinyl so I can play it on my setup. It's just not the same to click play in that Bandcamp window. And he said, oh, it's never coming out on vinyl. And I said, I have money and I don't like having it. So let me spend money to put this out on vinyl.
That's amazing.
Jesus, why don't you like Christ. Having money?
It's just like, I feel like it's much better to just spend it. Just spend it right away. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. Why not have something to show for it?
Have you always been like that?
I like things. I like acquiring things and buying things. Yeah. That should be obvious from the book. Even though it's a critique of, like, losers whose, like, only connection to the outside world is, like, the stuff they own. It's also, like, obviously me.
Can we play Fuck, Marry, Kill with Wichita, Cincinnati, and Milwaukee?
Yeah, it's pretty easy, I would say. I mean, obviously, kill Wichita. And, I would have to say marry Milwaukee because that's where I live now on a permanent residential basis. So we would fuck Cincinnati, which I would feel comfortable doing.
that's how I thought it might shake out.
I feel like you have to marry the city that you live in, unless like you're not you're there on a temporary basis. It's a commitment to live somewhere.
I mean, you lived in Cincinnati for 10 years.
10 years, and I love it. It's one of my favorite cities. It's my favorite kind of city. And I would say the same thing about Milwaukee, but not so much about Wichita. But I will say, like, I think, I wouldn't have the book without Wichita. It was the most interesting experience of my life living in Wichita. And the Wichitan response to the book, at least in terms of my reading, was like very positive. People were really happy, like just that there was a book set where they lived, and they took it in good humor and enjoyed the book, except for like one person who, like, I haven't looked at many of like the online like user reviews, but I know there was one person at the reading who was like pissed off later on and wrote a bad review of the book for whatever reason.
Wow.
Jesus.
But I was expecting that. I was expecting it like a more like universally pissed off response from Wichita.
You thought you were going to meet an angry crowd at the bookstore?
I thought maybe. I thought there was a chance. Not even about the book, but I lived in Wichita for 3 years where I did my MFA, and I probably made a fair amount of enemies, and that would have been a good opportunity for my enemies to show up.
Do you make a lot of enemies in your life?
I don't think so, but I think Wichita is like a very particular place, and it's like, the people I was there in Wichita with, like, we really feel like, this is obviously like very hyperbolic, but we really feel like it's like going off to war. It's like you can't explain what it was like. People will never understand what it was like in Wichita from 2008 to 2011. And it's just something that can't be shared with outsiders in any way that they'll ever understand.
All my experiences of Kansas are like pretty tame. So this is surprising information to me.
Well, I was talking with my friend who was there about it the other day, and we just realized like, oh, it was like full of people who were like late bloomers who like went through undergraduate as just like weird homebodies or like mama's boys. So like by the time we went to grad school is like we were like emotionally at the level of like an 18-year-old going off to freshman year.
Oh my God.
And we were like in charge of like teaching these 18-year-olds, but we were like barely emotionally beyond where they were. We were probably behind.
Are you working on anything new?
I am. I'm always working on something new. But I don't really talk about my in progress stuff a whole lot. I'm working on another novel, obviously, because you have to. You have to keep once you do it the first time. Although I do feel like the first novel seems like such a fluke that I feel like, you know, it's not a guarantee that my fans will ever get access to the second novel.
The ifs are hungry.
The ifs are hungry, yeah. But, you know, they could, you know, maybe they'll be able to, like, check it out at some university manuscript archive, the unpublished second novel someday.
Just hitting up that JSTOR.
JSTOR or, you know, illegallibrary.ru. It's probably your best bet.
Okay. Maybe Sam Sweet can help you.
There you go.
I mean, this is the thing. See, this is the thing. That's exactly the issue of, you know, I'm one of Sam Sweet's silent, unseen admirers.
But not anymore.
We've been talking about him a lot today.
Yeah,
I know. I broke the barrier, and yeah. I don't know how I feel about it. But he's probably not listening anyway.
Definitely not.
How dare you? He's definitely listening.
I have a couple other projects I could promote here if this is the promotional part.
Yes.
This whole thing is the promotional part. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wake up in the morning, it's the promotional part.
I mean, sometimes you might get a guest who's really, you can tell they're really there to give everyone a hard sell. And I'm that type of guest. So, you know, I have through my, you know, I call it the Works of Love imprint and the homage to the Wright Morris novel.
Amen.
And that's where I released the Benjamin Dean Wilson record. I don't know, my world famous, internationally distributed and admired tract about Doug Yule of the Velvet Underground can be purchased through this imprint. And I'm, you know, my next thing, you know, I really thought that I was getting way too much money from literary publishing. So my next big project is a zine that I'm printing at home.
Oh my God.
And this is it's a compendium, a guide of every Halloween themed TV episode that I watched from, you know, the year of my birth till 2004, the year I graduated high school. Wow. And this includes episodes that aired before I was born that I saw in my lifetime.
Jesus.
And it's, I call it free associations. So they're less reviews than my associations of, you know, what this episode makes me think of in my life. So it's got some deeply personal stuff in it.
I love that. I can't wait to read that.
Is the My So-Called Life Halloween episode mentioned?
It is, and it's an editor's pick.
Wow.
So right now, you can, on my Works of Love website, you can access it through my regular LukeGettis.com. You can purchase the preview edition, which offers a selection of picks from A through D. And then in October, I'm going to release the complete edition with which numbers like more than 100 pages.
Okay, I am on that website right now making that purchase.
You're doing such cool shit.
You are. You really are.
It seems I agree. I definitely agree. It seems like it would be easier for me if I would just like focus on one thing. Like I'm sure like my agent or whoever is not happy that I'm not like turning out a great marketable book, where I'm like, you know what I want to do is like I want to treat, you know, thinking about old TV episodes as a full-time job for a couple months so I can pound out a zine that I'll sell 10 copies of. But you know, that's the way I roll.
Yeah. I saw an agent on Twitter tell people, just so you know, your agent's not sitting around waiting on you, and that should be comforting. And it actually was comforting.
I don't believe that though. I think if you have an agent who is like, you know, also like Michael Chabon's agent or whatever, like, okay. But, I would like to think that, you know, my own agent is at least like one of my silent admirers, one of the unseen fans, one of the ifs.
One of the ifs for sure.
Well, if your agent's listening, can they confirm that to us at some point?
I mean, I hope that he's not. I wish you a wide audience, but you know, for this episode, you know, I feel like maybe people will turn it off a couple minutes in, and that's okay with me. I can't imagine what it is to listen to this episode. So if you made it to the end, I wouldn't congratulate you, but I would just ask you to think about it. Think about
think about your life.
I would say like I'm not as bad as you think I sound.
No. I mean, you are. Are you kidding me? As bad as that.
Yeah, you're definitely worse than that in a great way. I usually don't actually laugh. I usually fake laugh when people come on.
Yeah.
I'm a monster. But I love talking to you. You're funny.
I mean, that's good. I guess that's okay. It's just like sometimes you hear yourself and you're like, I don't even know if I believe what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, or I don't even know what I'm saying.
Alex confessed recently that he just lies all the time.
That's yeah. I mean, I didn't even feel like it was a confession. I thought it was just assumed.
Yeah. I mean, I think I understand where Alex is coming from, and it's just like easier to lie.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for everyone involved to lie.
Absolutely. There's so many situations where you just have to get through.
You just have to get through. Yeah. It's just
like this podcast.
Every podcast, Lindsay. You know,
I think it's because Alex and I are like, we're pretty layered individuals.
Okay. And yeah. Right. Righteous, righteous, righteous. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
So, I mean, sometimes it's just like, you know, I could give it to you. I could give it to you real, but it would take too long. It would take too long to explain what's up.
I can't wait for the time when we have Luke back on and he opens with, all right, I'm going to be giving it to you real for the next hour.
That
Cincinnati fuck style.
This is only part one. We have to have part two. I need to be giving it to me real.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if you've done any like themed holiday episodes, but you know, when this Halloween, you know, I have a feeling like the podcasts are going to be knocking down my door to talk about this.
Hell yeah.
But you know, I could add you to the list.
Get we us have on first the waiting dips. List, yeah.
Okay. We have for what is it called? First refusal. We have first refusal.
That I don't like that term. You just sent a chill down my spine. I know that
Halloween.
I know that's on my contract or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems inevitable.
It does.
Why wouldn't you refuse it?
Yeah, it happens to all of us.
Literally everybody. Luke, thank you so much for coming on. This was a blast. People should go get the book if they haven't. It's called Heart of Junk. And you definitely have to type his name into Google, find the website, click around. Just do
There's a lot. There's probably not as inviting as Sam Sweet's website, which you could also inviting. Go to.
It's pretty inviting.
Yeah, that's samsweet.info. And it's lukegeddes.com.
I love the pink. It's a nice pink.
I just changed it to pink pretty recently. I thought, like, we need some color here. I just, like, you know, I'll finish shortly, but, you know, I remember when I was coming up as a wannabe writer, and you would go to an author's website and they would have like a blog, and you would learn so much about them and like who they were as people, and you would see their interests. And now mm-hmm. it's like, now all you see is just like their idiotic thoughts on Twitter that don't even like tell you anything about who they are as people.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, I wanted my website to like confuse people, I think, and see like, oh, this is just some weird guy, as opposed to like, this is just about a book or whatever.
I love it.
I'm mesmerized by your screen printed t-shirts right now.
Yeah, oh, those man. Feel very up your alley, Lindsay.
Yes, I love
them. I have a few. I've got a few if you want to order one, but email me ahead of time because some of them turned out bad and I don't want to send you a bad one.
Oh, I love the Rock and Roll Madness one.
That's a good one. Oh, yeah.
The Purple People Eater. My kids love that song.
That was my first favorite song. That and the Big Bopper. And
oh, my I really God.
Feel my taste just emerge out of those two songs.
My six-year-old was telling the neighbor, yeah, my favorite musician is the Big Bopper. You know, hello, baby. You know, Chantilly Waste.
This is Towns?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And they were like, wait, that, what?
I mean that's so heartening to me that the big bopper is still out there reaching the youth.
Oh hell yeah. They're obsessed with American Pie, so they know all about the plane crash that killed Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Richie
Valens. Buddy Holly and the others.
And the others. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Including the Big Bopper and yeah, so they know a lot about all that. And they love Buddy Holly, too.
Buddy Holly, I just think constantly, like, oh, man. It's a weird thing to think about, but, like, what if he lived? What if
Buddy Holly... Isn't that crazy? And he was a baby. He was, like, what, 22?
Really?
He was 22. He was, like, a year and a half into his music career. That's like, insane. Imagine Buddy Holly responding to the Beatles or Buddy Holly responding to, like, punk.
Well, they absolutely loved him.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why they called themselves the Beatles after the Crickets. So, yeah, you can just see, like, that he would have... I mean, and his stuff still slaps. You know, that's...
Yeah. I don't think, like, the Big Bopper had that much more left to him. Like, yeah. I don't know if, like...
He was Culture definitely when, of his time.
Yeah, but Buddy Holly, I feel like, was ready to, like, get into some shit in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. God, yep. Can you imagine those Buddy Holly's records in the 70s? They would have been nuts.
I really feel like he would have been a new wave guy. The new wave kids would have really taken him in. I mean, they did anyway, but if he could have been there for it. You know, that's my next novel, Buddy Holly fan fiction.
Please.
That sounds good.
Do it. Okay, goodbye, Luke.
Okay.
Have a good night, Luke.
All right. Bye.
That was so good.
I loved it. I mean, yeah. I mean, I wasn't kidding. Like, I really find Luke fucking hilarious, and that's the ideal person I want to talk to. Just another lunatic like me, just another fucking lunatic out in the Midwest.
It's great to talk to people who aren't like, and what about my brand? And like, should I be on Twitter? And what should I? It's like, he's just doing stuff that he wants to do that he finds. Yes,
and it's all amazing. I mean, truly the the shirts, the zines, the posters, all that shit is fucking wild. You should check it out. It's cool.
I had a zine in high school.
Did you?
It's time to bring it back. Yeah. It was called Pant Load. It was 4 issues.
I feel like that foretold your marriage to Ben.
Probably. Probably. Yeah, I could see that.
That's a compliment, by the way. Oh, man.
How you been?
I've been good.
Yeah.
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 What about you?
Good. Yeah. I just got back from Ragdale. I hosted through Story Studio in Chicago. I hosted a retreat there. I don't know if that's how you put it. I was the writer conducting the sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And
the cult leader.
I was the cult leader. Yep. Mm-hmm. And it was 11 students and we did a bunch of sessions and then broke out and did, you know, writing time, and they have an amazing chef there who makes all the meals. And it was like this beautiful property, like north, like in Lake Forest on a prairie.
That's where it is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really close.
For some reason, I thought it was like way north.
Yeah, no, it's I thought that too, but it was like a 40-minute drive.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So that was great. I didn't get as much writing as I thought I would, but I did. Mm-hmm. I touched a story. I messed with it. And that's a lot more than I've done in a long time. So that was nice.
That's great.
Yeah. Now I'm home on the range.
That's awesome. Let's see what's been going on. I've been in like a serious cleaning mode. I'm not talking like normal domestic duties, which I embrace daily. I mean like getting rid of books, getting rid of just like getting rid of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been making me feel really good.
That stuff can start to like close in on you, you know?
Yeah. I don't think I realized how much it was like impact. Like I don't know. I think it was having a weird impact on me. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Just, and part of it is, even though this like little stupid podcast that we have that nobody listens to, we still get sent a shitload of books
constantly.
Like we're nobody, especially me. And it's like, I have so many goddamn books just from the show.
Yeah.
And I'm also the kind of asshole who buys books. So it's like, it's too many books.
I usually go to the library, but yeah, I feel like so cool that books are sent to me, but like,
I know
I should put a picture of my nightstand right now because it's ridiculous.
Yeah, no, 100% same way. And like I have, when I was going through books to donate, there were so many things that I had multiple copies of that I had no idea I had multiple copies of, unrelated to the show. And then for the show, I feel like this happens a lot. Maybe it happens more now than when we started, but people will send us the arc and then they'll send us the finished copy too.
Yes.
And I'm like, listen, very cool. Thank you, but not
too
necessary.
Much. Yes.
Totally unnecessary.
Yes.
Like the arc is enough.
But also thank you.
Yeah, but also thank you. Kinda. Yeah. What else is going on? I don't know.
Ben had a sports take, but I don't remember what it was.
Oh.
So we'll just leave everyone in suspense there.
Next week.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a fun one. We didn't talk much about the book, but I will say Heart of Junk is a good book. I enjoyed it when I read it 2 years ago. And the interview I did with Luke on Heavy Feather Review it's good. So check it out. If you want to read more about the book itself, we kind of, you know, this was like my ideal episode where we just bullshit for an hour or whatever, but Heart of Junk is really good. And it's very dark despite the cover. And it's just a fucking weird book. It's great.
That's my favorite description of a book. It's weird.
Yeah.
Love that. Right.
Same. Absolutely. And I feel like Yeah, I have no thoughts actually.
I think that is exactly what an invisible fan would say.
Yeah, that's what an if would do.
Mm-hmm.
Not think.
That's right.
All right, right. Bud. Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
I'm excited to hear you read. So just think about that.
I mean, that makes it worse, but that's okay.